You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
Let's do it later.
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes.
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy?
Fall Guy.
That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th, hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
With threats to our nation waiting around every corner, adaptability is more important than ever. When conditions change without notice, quick strategic thinking is crucial, and with obstacles consistently impending, determination is essential in overcoming them. It's this willingness, decisiveness, and resilience that sets Marines apart. With our fighting spirit, we don't just fight battles, we win them. Marines are the constant our nation counts on to fight the unknown, and through adaptable problem solving, we do just that. Learn more at marines.com.
Welcome to Beyond the Game. My name is Gregan, and today we're going to be talking with Frankie Ward.
Yeah, so I was a senior content producer at the BBC. So my job was to take this BBC Live project that they developed for the Olympics.
Yeah, and then I remember 2019 was Frankie's year, wasn't it? It was, you just did everything everywhere, it felt like.
I did so many games in 2018. In 2019, I did 20 Counter-Strike events, so 19 as talent, one as press. I can be quite direct with my interviews because I've got 90 seconds usually. And I don't have time to be honest, to sugarcoat things. I've got to get in there and I've got to get my answers. So
make sure to follow for future episodes. It really means a lot. I hope you enjoy this conversation as we get to know Frankie beyond the game. Frankie, welcome. I want to first start off with the beginning and we'll get on to where you are now, but you're one of the most interesting people for me in esports and gaming because you've gone through such a journey before doing what you do now, but we don't typically talk about the bit before you started working in esports. So what was young Frankie like growing up?
I love that. You had a life before. Yeah, it's your polite way of saying, Frankie, you're old. So tell us what it's like to not grow up in esports. What was my life like before? I think people know my origin story quite a bit because I worked on a League of Legends event. So I was a producer for nearly a decade before that. Pretty standard, you know. My first gaming experience was on my dad's work laptop. Then I did do a play in London, which is probably not everyone's experience, but I used that money to buy PlayStation 1. Couldn't afford the game, so I delved into bargain buckets and probably when Woolworths and Blockbuster still existed. So ended up with, to be fair, classics like Buster Groove and then terrible games like Bubsy 3D, which still haunts my dreams. So
I'm
it was
really
fairly
sad to say I don't know these games.
You should never know Bubsy 3D because it's a monstrosity. It's known as one of the worst games of all time, up there with Echo the Dolphin, which is a much older reference. And Buster Groove was a rhythm game. It was originally called Buster Move, the Japanese title translated, I believe. And it had about 10 songs, one for each of the characters. And yeah, it was a rhythm game. It was more focused on controller rather than dance mat. And it was catchy as hell. And so if anyone knows Buster Groove, they'll know the song.
So have you continued to play those kind of games or was that just an entry point for you with gaming?
I played Trombone Champ the other day and I think it was a bit too frenetic for my main model, my Twitch channel, Isabel, bless her. She's a legend, by the way. I think she found it a bit too frenetic. So I haven't streamed it since, sadly, but it was such a joy to play. If you've not played Trombone Champ, you're controlling with a mouse the trombone slider. So obviously click your mouse to start playing the note and then down to slide, although I've just got a wireless mouse, so actually I need to play it again to see if I can be better at it.
Nice.
Maybe
try.
Increase my DPI. So I do love those games.
And so what sort of age were you when you started gaming?
I can't really remember. I was super young. So the first internet browser was invented in 1993, and that was called Netscape. So before that, you had platforms like AOL. And, you know, you've got Mail, and it had something called YooHooligans. And so I'd play games on that. Played Hugo Whodunit, which was a point-and-click adventure. Monkey Island 2. And I played Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, which was text-based only. So my first game was either Hugo Whodunit or Hitchhiker's, which is bizarre because you die so easily in Hitchhiker's. You know, the first thing you do is you wake up dark, like in darkness, and you have to turn on the light switch. But there's no, like, options. You're literally typing out options, trying to find things.
Yeah, because the text-based adventure games were sort of where it all started in gaming. Because I remember, was it Robotron and the Dark Room? So have you ever seen that?
John Robertson. I know John Robertson. Yeah.
And like he sort of
You're in a dark room. Yeah.
That's Darren! Just the first thing I thought of when he described that was his whole
idea. Yeah, but his idea. has got options. You can't type
You had to type them out.
That would be like amazing if John ever did like the text-based version of that. I don't know if it would work with an audience, like having to give people a keyboard instead of having his controller attached to his front. Uh-huh. But John's in comedy as well, and I used to work in comedy before I worked in gaming. So,
okay, so what was your journey through school and university, all that kind of stuff? What route did you take?
So I was at grammar school, not private school, but it was selective. So I went to an all-girls school, boys in sixth form. So I lived in the countryside, middle of nowhere. So when I was 14, getting the PlayStation 2 a few years after everyone else was the greatest gift ever. Like playing Final Fantasy 10 when I was 16. I'd finished my GCSEs. I spent like 2 weeks pretty much in bed, apart from the odd shower and food. And, you know, food was obviously taken in bed while, you know, swooning over Puna and Tidus. And, I actually got to move to Maidstone where I went to school in my last year of school, which was such a game changer because finally I could walk to school instead of doing a two-hour commute. And
2 hours.
Yeah. But I loved school. I'm someone who still is like, right, gotta do the homework on the first night. You know, if I'm prepping for an event, I'm like do a lot of prep before I get there and things like that. And I've always quite liked that. I find it quite satisfying to have that level of organization. I'm not the neatest person in the world, but I used to be very organized. And then university, I studied drama theatre arts, but it was not a drama school, it was a academic course at the University of Birmingham. Didn't really like my university that much. I ran a radio station there and the university were not supportive of us. It was a difficult time, but we had to go off air after a few weeks of me literally being at uni. It wasn't my fault. I was just but a humble member of the station at that point before I suddenly ended up running the thing. And we had to go off air because we were a fire hazard. And the irony was we were called Burn FM. So, yeah, while they put air conditioning in our studio, which was next to the boiler in the Guild of Students, I went out in Birmingham into the town centre and I used to go to loads of gigs and review things. And I would pretend that the radio was not off the air to get interviews with bands like the Future Heads and things. So that kind of got me into doing media and kind of radio stuff. And I always wanted to do radio when I was a kid. So, yeah, that kind of got me there. And then I started freelancing after I'd done some internships at the BBC and Channel 4. And I ended up working for this radio station in Newcastle. So I recorded my first national radio show that was on digital. So like that sounds like so much cooler than it actually was when I was 20 years old. But it came out when I was 21. So again, I don't know if I was the youngest DJ on national radio, but not as cool as it sounds.
I mean,
no one listened.
What I'm taking from all that is that you went above and beyond quite early on because you loved doing media-based stuff.
Yeah, I didn't want to go home. I loved the fact that I wasn't living in Maidstone under someone else's rules and things like that. Like my parents were not really like strict. They weren't like hands-on. I was always very independent. I cooked for myself from about the age of 8 when I turned vegetarian. I sometimes would get the bus home from school when I was like 9. So I'd always been someone who wanted to have that like space for themselves and things and like independent. And because I was so organized, I've never had any concerns about that. So I in my mind, it was like, right, I need to be working straight away. So I got the job before I graduated. I moved to Newcastle. I came back to uni to graduate. I even chose for my final module. I wrote a play and then did a half dissertation. I didn't do a practical performance, even though I was a good actor. I did a professional role when I was in my first year of uni. But I just wanted to do the admin and get out. So I did. and then the radio station wasn't that great an experience. But yeah, I've always been like, you've got to be independent, you've got to earn money. I got my first flat with shared ownership, but I got it when I was 23.
So with that whole journey, mm-hmm. you didn't expect to be an esports host, you didn't expect to work in esports, you found that out later on. What were your intended goals? Where were you intending to land with all this experience?
I didn't know. Do you mean when I was graduating uni?
Yeah, so when you were doing this radio, media and journalism kind of stuff.
I wanted to work and I wanted to be producing something. So when I left the radio station after about 9 months of being full-time in Newcastle, I wrote to everyone because I got made redundant. I wrote to like all these people that I'm work experience with and things. And then I walked into Channel 4 less than 2 weeks, about, in fact, 2 weeks later as a producer. And probably could have stayed there longer because I had a 6 month contract, but I was so freaked out about the idea that I might not get renewed that I then went to Sky for like another 7 months before I ended up at the BBC. So yeah, my aim was to kind of work and also to enjoy it and things, but I've always gone between different genres and things like that. It was always for me trying to be creative and do the best job possible. Mm-hmm. So I'm used to having no budget and yeah, trying to turn ideas around and things like that. And I've always really enjoyed doing that. The only thing I don't enjoy so much is doing it on my own all the time. So I like writing on my own, but you know, when I'm making videos and things like that, I would rather be in a team with people for sure.
Mm-hmm. And then 2015 was your first esports gaming event you did through media.
Yeah, so I was a senior content producer at the BBC. So my job was to take this BBC Live project that they developed for the Olympics. So I had multiple live streams. So because they didn't have enough channels to show all the games at once, there was a text and multimedia kind of live blog that went alongside that. So my job was to take that to different teams in the BBC and be like, you should use this. So I was technically working for BBC Sport, even though I wasn't really doing any sport. And then along came this collaboration between BBC Sport and BBC Three around this League of Legends event. Now, there was no BBC Three input. I remember having a meeting with this guy just come in from Vice to run like BBC Three online when everything was going digital on their end. And he was like, why are we having this meeting? And I was like, because it's got BBC Three on top of it. I thought you'd want some kind of editorial input. No? Okay, fine. So I wasn't running the broadcast side. I was running I built the website and then was doing the editorial on that side of things. I was working with a caster called Richard Polscam, who now is in Australia, does the Australian League of Legends stuff. Such a lovely guy. And the experience was great because I was meeting people in the audience at Wembley every day, like meeting a kid on the tube because he saw my lanyard, thought I worked for Riot. And then I was like, actually, I'm BBC. And he was like, oh, I heard you're doing a great job. I'll leave you. And I was like, no, we're going to walk and we're going to talk if that's okay. And looking on Reddit and things because we didn't have a Twitch chat. And that's when I discovered Twitch. But I really enjoyed that event. I loved the atmosphere in the stadium. It wasn't like other sports events. Bear in mind, I went on to live near Millwall Stadium for a while. And I was a Palace fan. I had season tickets when I was younger. So it's quite scary, Millwall Stadium, for me. And yeah, it was a very different vibe. And I really liked that. And I felt like, oh, I never thought I could work in video games before this moment. But actually, this isn't a thing. So that's when I kind of started researching Twitch and the job came up because you can stagnate at the BBC very easily. I did 4 different jobs over like 4 years. And when I left, my team bought me a little necklace that said, Ask Frankie, because I was really well connected and I wanted to bring people together and get them using this platform that I was an ambassador for, you know, BBC Live, but also get them everyone experienced in using our content management systems. Shout out to BBC employees, iSight, I broadcast to. And yeah, just get people confident. Like when I ran a team doing websites for independent productions, so non-in-house BBC productions, it was like, right, okay, if this is, we'd look at the numbers, what these sites were getting, you know, you gotta be data driven in your approach. And if it was a popular show with a popular website like Bake Off, well, you put more resources into that, you go out and you get interviews and you do all these things and you give the viewer a more enriched experience. Whereas if it's a daytime show that doesn't have any interest on the website, you don't put any resource into it. So I wanted the people who were on my team to actually get to do editorial and not feel like they were just glorified uploaders. Mm. You know, that was my approach to things.
Yeah,
but there's only so far you can go with that.
The Ask Frankie thing, I think, as soon as you said that, I was like, oh, that sounds like you, because my first experience meeting you was you were the stage manager or producer.
I was the producer of the stage at Insomnia. Yeah, the Twitch Insomnia. Stage, yeah.
And instantly myself and the Rocket League team could tell that you would go above and beyond for things, because typically you go backstage, you ask, can you do this? Can you do that? Is it possible to do this? And you were one of those people who goes, I will find a way. And yes, I will find a way. It was never, not sure. Because there's a lot of people out there in any industry who know is the easy answer because it saves them work. But you cared so much about your role that you were trying to find a way to do it and maybe even come to us with ideas, be like, hey, can you try this? Do you want to try this?
Yeah.
And so instantly I recognize you as someone who would be, I'd want to work with in the future if possible. And then sort of a year later, I was like, hang on a minute, that's Frankie. Why is she standing there with a mic? Because you were backstage for all this time. You worked behind the scenes all this time. And then you sort of started finding your way into in front of camera work. How did that first come about?
Well, thank you. I had no budget. I had so little money and I was using Twitch partners as hosts. And so when you're doing shows that are 12 hours long and you've only got two hosts, they've got to have breaks and it's not fair for them constantly to be there. And sometimes we'd be doing a show, say, with like 30 different games a day at EGX, and my host might not know the game. Like, I had two hosts 1 year, they didn't know Final Fantasy. And I was like, oh, I got 45 minutes dedicated to Final Fantasy 15 and like gameplay on this stage, because it's going to be one of the really big releases this year, but also like I'm kind of biased towards it. And it was the first slot of the day, so I was like, they can have this time.
I'll take this one, guys.
Yeah. So, well, I went on stage with them to kind of hold their hands a bit, but also because I am really organized as a producer with my run of show and everything. I've got my durations. The production teams I work with, they always knew what they needed to do and things like that. So I knew that I could be on that stage at certain times. I was not on that stage all the time, but there might be like a segment in the day where I'd go on either to cover or to kind of help. I remember one time that the sales team had sold a slot for a game and it was meant to be in English language, but it was on a day which was German broadcast language focused in at Gamescom. And so my English language hosts weren't there anymore, weren't available. So I went on with another staff member from Twitch. Shout out to James Duffield, doing all the shout outs today. And we hosted this thing together because there wasn't anyone else to do it. But because I'd been doing all the research for that segment and things, like, and I had a production meeting with the guys because they were going to be on the stage I was producing, like, I think we did a really good job. So yeah, I had experience, and I got asked after that event to do Jinx TV as well. So I just used to go to Jinx, to the studios every Thursday after work and do a show for 2 hours. So when the day I got made redundant from Twitch, I literally left the office about 3:30, went to Acosta, called my dad, Adamone. Then I went up to the studio and did my last show at Jinx. So it was like I ended kind of two chapters on that day.
And you had some pretty big turnaround of events after that. And it was 2018, wasn't it?
Where... Yeah, I remember having a meeting with my friend Britt, who was becoming my manager, taking over from DJ Wee at Twitch. So she was sort of transitioning into a higher role, higher power. And she said to me, we had a meeting with the PC Gamer guys, because Twitch has meetings with the show, the E3 press conferences that they are co-streaming, right? And well, they're not even co-streaming, they're like, they are broadcasting them. And Britt's husband, Day 9, he hosts that show. And they had a meeting, I guess talent had come up in conversation. And they said, oh, we're thinking about Frankie. And now I didn't know this. I wasn't in that meeting. And Britt said to me, are you doing the PC gaming show this year? And because you should tell us if you are, because we might want you to come and work E3. I said, no, I did PC gaming show in London in February. I have no idea what you're talking about. But I promise you, I would tell you. I remember I was at court being so confused. And then a week later, my agent at the time was just like, so PC gaming show? And I was like, oh my God. I got made redundant, and literally a week later I was picked up to do that show. I'd already been talking to Joe Miller at ESL about doing a couple of very small things. In fact, one small thing. And so when I left, it was similar to when I lost my job at the radio station in Newcastle. I promise I'm not a terrible person to work with. And I sent emails out. I did exactly the same thing when I left Twitch. The difference was those people didn't know me as a host. They knew me as a producer, and I didn't use and abuse those contacts. The only person I spoke to about hosting who was a producer I work with, a project manager I work with, was Will Atwood, who now works at Riot, because we were mates. And I mentioned that I'd like to host. And so he did get me to do a Hearthstone event, which was over a weekend. So it wasn't a conflict. It was on Twitch, you know, all that kind of stuff. Mm. And yeah, I started emailing these people like Dreamhack and things like that. And I had some clips from Jinx and things. I had a showreel and I started getting booked straight away.
Yeah, and then I remember 2019 was Frankie's year, wasn't it? It was, you just did everything everywhere, it felt like.
I did so many games in 2018. In 2019, I did 20 Counter-Strike events, so 19 as talent, one as press. And then I did some other games as well. So yeah, I think I did like less than 30, more than 25 events, maybe 26 events.
So 2018 was the mixture year where you did a bit of everything, yeah, tried out stuff. And then 2019, yeah, you solidified I Am CSGO a bit more.
Yeah, exactly. So 2018, I did a fair bit of PUBG, which is fab. What a great scene to kind of first set out your stall, because I had Sims, who's now my agent, Pansy, Toffee's Matchroom, just like Cammy, just these brilliant people to work with. Hypok was a player at the time, then he became PUBG talent after my time in that scene, and now he's one of the great Valorant talents. They were just really brilliant people to be around. And oh god, I've not mentioned other people. Avenger, Kolaris, I feel guilty for not mentioning everyone.
This is always the case. If people start shouting out, if you don't then go through everyone, you always feel guilty afterwards.
Yeah,
so even though you thought about them, you just haven't gone through and named them. I'm sure they'll be
yeah,
fine.
So if I've missed anyone out, I'm so, Froz, I'm so sorry if I've missed you out, but you're all legends. And I was just made to feel part of something straight away, even though I was new to that scene. Mm. I feel like really, really lucky that that was kind of the first thing that I got to do, really. I got to do some CS straight away because James Bardolph saw me do this thing called the Camden Premiere, because I was doing this NHL thing. Someone from FaZe Hit, my friend Jazz, was there, and he asked me if I could do Counter-Strike. So 5 days later, I'm doing something for FaZe Hit, and then that leads to doing the FaZe Hit Minor. And then I go straight to Las Vegas to do WSOE PUBG for Richard Lewis because he was working there at the time. I did lots of stuff. Overwatch. I can't even remember
everything.
You did some
Hearthstone, I believe, right?
I did a little bit more Hearthstone. Yeah, I did EGX 2018, yeah, where that's kind of known in the community because of an incident on stage with, oh my God, have I forgotten his name? It begins with a P. Dude, I'm so sorry.
Oh, I mean, you've met so many different players.
The trophy
and
falling off.
Talent across the games.
Yeah.
It's hard to remember everyone's name. So yeah, there was a trophy fell off.
You lift the trophy and then the lid fell off.
Oh.
Oh my God. No, that's going to drive me crazy. I will probably at some point in the podcast, I will shout his name out.
We could get Harry to Google it for us.
Oh my God.
There you go. That might satisfy you.
EGX 2018 ESL UK Hearthstone Premier.
this is our first Googling podcast.
I've worked in so many games. I think, to be fair, I think Golden Boy has worked in way more than me, but I wanted to be European Golden Boy when I set out to, you know, be an esports host and stuff. So
I'm sure, yeah, I'm sure if Golden Boy heard that would be quite an honor for him, because I think a lot of people in esports get so short term in terms of how long we've been doing it for. People forget that they're role models, and like, you're a role model to so many people who want to host, but like, you don't realize that, right? Like, when I've seen you on stage, I've been like, right, Frankie's a great example of do this, this, and this. Like, one of the big things, speaking of stuff that you've done a lot of, is you've interviewed some of the most intimidating characters, like Dr. Disrespect, for example. A lot of people would struggle on stage with big personalities like that, whereas you come out as the, I almost want to say like the winner of the interview, even though there's not winner, but like, you come out with the like classic British banter of like, hey, I'll get you if you get me kind of thing. And I remember seeing that interview, and that was one of the moments where I was like, Frankie's going to be a host for as long as people want her, because of that sort of stage presence, which is, I think, something that's so hard to come across in esports, is people who can own a stage, right?
Mm. Oh, thank you. I really enjoyed doing that charity thing for PUBG, because I wasn't the main stage host, Cammy was. They just randomly got me to do the charity morning last minute, and I remember being on comms. It wasn't I think it was a Chinese production company, so there weren't many native English speakers on production, and I remember you know, us being close to the broadcast and being, I was in my, this off, actually, this is not the only time it's happened. It's happened so many times when you're on the stage and I'm just like with my in-ears in, my IFB and my micro, and I'm just like, so which camera am I going to? Can someone just tell me which camera I'm going to? Which camera am I going to? Which? And I'm hearing the count and I'm like, you're not hearing me, so I better shut up because you might open my mic too early. Normally they open it too late, but occasionally you get hot mic. So I was just literally just like, bah! And I sort of tried to go over what I was going to say. But the interview is always where I'm most comfortable.
I remember I've had that exact thing before where I stopped speaking. So instead started using my hand gestures to be like, and then it cuts to me being like, hi guys.
Yeah, that's happened to me a few times for sure.
Yeah.
I feel like this last year, I should say it's not this year anymore, was the first time I've been like, yeah, I really, really loved that stage moment, I think, was in Antwerp, because I definitely had a period in 2019 where I had to fill in on stage, and I don't think it was production's fault really, but I had it kind of into my head that I couldn't be myself because I wasn't like honorable enough to be on the stages that I was hosting on, you know, rather than being myself, I was a bit scared. Whereas I wouldn't have been doing that, like when I was doing Hearthstone, for example, for ESL UK. So I kind of lost a bit of that.
Why do you feel that way? Why do you feel like you don't deserve to be on stage?
I feel like I do now after Antwerp. I think it was just because I was at Katowice in 2019 and I had to fill the quarterfinals for because OJ couldn't make it, and OJ is just the master. I could dissect what he does and why he does it so well and why he's the best at what he does. But we don't have time for that. But I knew I wasn't him and he should be there. And I was sort of told like the stage is a place of honor and like you've got to, you know, be respectful. When you're at the size of the stage during the show match, that's fine, but you've got to honor the moment and the situation. And so I remember coming out, like I didn't do any kind of big opening really, I was just doing like the doing interviews and stuff. But I remember being like, oh, gotta be really, really careful not to be myself because I might say something that's too silly for the stage or something. So I went to Chicago and had to do a similar thing because OJ couldn't make it out. I was a bit happier with myself out there, but I still wasn't like 100% what I think I could be doing. But I wasn't getting feedback because I wasn't time. And actually Carmack from ESL, Sean from ESL actually said sorry to me about that because they were like, oh, we felt like we were not there for you. And they are the best people giving feedback in this business. So I know that they genuinely meant that. Mm-hmm. So when it came to PGO and Antwerp, I was just like, right, okay, I've got to just do it my way. And I didn't get to do interviews either. So I had very little opportunity to make any kind of impact on that stage. And I didn't have much time to do sort of crowd work. So I was like, when you're doing crowd work, there's only so much you can do in terms of, you know, make some noise for this, that, and the other.
Mm.
So I was like, well, we're not going to do that then. I'm going to make them hyped from what I'm saying as opposed to asking them to be hyped. And I feel like, especially with the finals moment, I think we did achieve that and stuff. And then I saw on YouTube, Richard Lewis had done a video where he rated the talent, which I didn't watch. But I saw in the comments, someone said, I thought Frankie was uninspiring. And I was like, suddenly so deflated. Because when I had to do the opening sort of ceremony thing, speech, didn't lift the trophy, but I wrote this like 2-3 minute thing and drilled it and drilled it and delivered it. And it in the arena, it felt really good. And the talent actually were really, really lovely about it and said they enjoyed it and things. And then when you watch it on the broadcast, I don't think the sound doesn't kind of portray the atmosphere in that room. So it's just a girl in an oversized suit, like talking about trophies and empty cabinets and things.
You get a lot. I mean, this isn't just you. This is a women in gaming thing in general. But you get a lot of people forming opinions on you, whether it be good or bad, right?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, yeah.
And that's just, if you stand out on a broadcast for whatever reason, if you look different, if you're from a different game or whatever it is, if you're the odd one out, people will try and find a way to make an opinion on you. So consequently, you get a lot more feedback from the people you don't want to get feedback from. And you mentioned it there that you read the comments, you read social media and things
like that. I don't as much.
As much.
But I did see that and then I was like, don't watch the video. Richard could have said lovely things about me. I'm sure Richard was very fair. He could have been critical about me as well. But I didn't read it. I didn't watch it. I do respect Richard's work very much, but I was like, I don't need to watch this because the performance is done. I've watched what I've done back, so I can self-critique myself.
Yeah, and I guess that's where I'm coming from here is that you've got that ability to self-critique. You mentioned people who give you feedback and your peers and the people who are close to you, the most important feedback. But when you're in the public eye, you can't really help but see those comments out there. Yeah. How do you personally deal with being in the public eye and dealing with the social media feedback that people give, whether it be good or bad?
I don't think I'm that, I at least at the moment, because I haven't in the last year done as much stuff. So I don't think I'm that much of a hot topic right now. And I don't think I'm getting many comments and things like that.
I don't
really go to Reddit anymore, which is a shame because I'd like to actually take part in some posts and things like that. But I don't anymore. When I first started doing CS kind of more on a full-time basis, because I did a few events in 2018, but 2019 I did the major and people were like, who the hell is this? and I can be quite direct with my interviews because I've got 90 seconds usually. I don't have time to be honest, to sugarcoat things. I've got to get in there and I've got to get my answers. So some people thought I was probably too direct, especially after the first week. The first few days I spent way too long trying to kind of set context up and show I've done my research, blah, blah, blah. Blah, blah, blah. And Carmack from ESL gave me the feedback that he wanted it more dynamic and things. And I was like, okay. And I went back, I watched myself and I went, oh my God, I think it's well. I was like, Jesus, he's absolutely 100% right. Okay, I went back and I was so much better at my job. But some people found that kind of real, like, back and forth thing. They found that a bit hard to deal with, I think. And, you know, especially the way I dealt with the Na'vi storyline, which was the fact that they were falling apart. I asked Edward if they were going to stay together and if they wanted to stay together and win the major. And people were just like, she's such a bitch and stuff, which I kind of found quite funny, to be honest. But I definitely saw stuff about me that wasn't true and that I only asked yes, no questions and things like that. And it was not, I asked short questions, but I wasn't asking just binary questions. I sometimes ask them to end an interview. So that I found really difficult. And then the community started to accept me after a little while and all that kind of stuff. So I definitely learned, just don't read the comments, don't read the Twitch chat too much and all that kind of stuff. Cause you want to interact with the community, but sometimes you've got to know when to separate yourself. So I don't really go out looking for myself too much. Mm-hmm. With Dota, when I did TI, when I was like 7 months pregnant, I avoided Reddit. I didn't look at it. And then I knew that I started to hear that things were being said and people were being beyond mean about me. And I hadn't experienced something that was like that heated before. But I knew it was becoming a thing. And so we had started to get locked down in Romania because the COVID infections were like in Bucharest. I can't remember what the city was in Romania.
Is it Bucharest?
Yeah, you know what? I'm so worried I'm going to get... Yeah, it was Bucharest. I'm so worried I'm going to say Budapest by accident. I sound like such an idiot, honestly. Yeah. Oh, it's my daughter's first birthday tomorrow, so I've got too many things in my head. We started to have to be in our hotel rooms and stuff, but we were working such long days, there was no real time for anything but sleep and work. But I did a Twitter thread and just being like, here's why I don't read the comments, because when I first started in CS, like, this really affected me, and you know, and I tried to explain it in a nice way, and that made people even angrier. I remember some guy sent me an email which was telling me how to do my job, and I sort of scanned the first few lines and I just deleted it. Like, that is a boundary you do not cross.
Because this is speaking about telling you how to do your job, in terms of our industry, I look at people like you and Ian Chambers, where we're like, you're the few people who've gone through the actual learning process of to do. You learn how to produce, you learn how to do the whole show. So as a host, one of the key elements, you have to know how to run the show, right? You're the face of the run of show, essentially. And you've learned the other side of that, so you know how to deal with that. Like you said, you used to produce shows and then go out on stage and host the show that you'd produced. So you've got a lot more experience than most people. And I think whenever you see people giving you feedback, they're giving it from a place of no experience. They don't know what they want, but they didn't like something you said. And like every host, every talent in the history of esports has been someone's least favorite or most favorite talent, right? But the problem that is faced in our industry is that the women will get targeted if they are someone's least favorite, or some people will just instantly dislike someone straight away from the tiniest of things. And how, because you represent a lot of things in this industry, I think, and you're very vocal about the things you represent, and you've got a lot of different experiences. But the biggest one, women in gaming, is something you've actually changed my view on in the past, because we spoke at one point about why there aren't women competing in gaming, and you definitely mm-hmm. opened my eyes to the societal side of things a lot more, and the like challenges faced with, you know, being put off early on. And then consequently, I've now played Valorant with a lot of my female friends, and that means that I am able to see it firsthand and watch a lot of their streams. So you've educated me, and I'm sure you've educated lots of other people. Do you feel like there is a pressure to do that, or is that something that you just do naturally?
I think I just don't understand sometimes. I don't understand how people can be so determined to think less of others. I don't understand that to me. Mm-hmm. It's just like, why wouldn't you want to lift others up? Why mm-hmm. why have you decided that people are limited?
Mm-hmm.
That for me is such a bizarre thing. Like, shouldn't you be wanting to see the best people possible, to have the best environment to see people succeed? So when you're seeing like game changes now with Valorant, you're seeing tournaments that are getting like a quarter of a million like concurrent viewers, because it's been given this treatment it deserves, and people are being given a platform, and it's changing people's minds and things, and there is an audience for it.
Mm.
So yeah, I think I haven't set out to be a role model, and I don't think I am one, and I haven't set out to change things necessarily. I mean, there are things I'd like changed, and you know, maybe I probably would have had an easier path if I had not said anything. But I know I've rubbed people up the wrong way, like, you know, things like talking about, I remember once in 2019 tweeting about equal money in tennis. People are so determined that women shouldn't have equal pay in tennis. Mm. I'm just like, there are different generations of tennis players. And so, yes, at the moment we're just coming out of the Serena era, and in the men's game, there's, you know, there's several male players, although really there's like two or three that everyone talks about, right? Mm. You want to inspire as many Serenas as possible, but also you want it to be fair, and the viewership numbers tend to be based on who is playing, actually, rather than the specific scene, at least from my experience anyway. But also, you don't necessarily know how far that scene is going to go if you don't give it support. So take the Euros with the women's football team. It was only really a few years ago that they started to get Liverpool salaries. And now they've won the Euros. And actually, people were sitting down and watching the games and going, oh, hang on a second, this is really good football. This is really entertaining to watch. Yes, it is. Of course it is. But the thing is, back in like, when was it? It was, I think, women's like FA games became legal again in like the late 70s or something. Mm. Women's football was banned for 50 years. 50 years, because it was becoming more popular than the men's game.
Yeah.
And so it fell behind in terms of popularity and financing and things, because we put a limit on it.
Yeah.
So actually, yeah, you should be taking money from other scenes and putting it into this scene, because this scene was held back for so long. And if sponsors are happy to put up money for women in gaming, and if women are currently having a separate stage, then fine, because then you're widening the talent pool. And once you have a wider talent pool, you're going to see people with more potential. There's going to be more people with the potential needed to succeed. And at the moment, it's a very small pool.
Yeah, I mean, I'm on the desk for Women's Carball, which is a community run with some money funding to run a women's league for Rocket League. And within that scene, the players are developing incredibly fast right now, because a lot of women who didn't think they could compete are now thinking, oh, we can scrim together. We can start practicing. I can put organize. Hours into this. I can try and make it to the top, where previously they would have felt like, oh, I'm not meant to do this. And I think through speaking to you and talking about the challenges of the societal side, and I think that's the important side to educate, because if there is any biological reason, we can't know until there is a societal factor that allows it to be balanced, because that's the case in all sport, right? Like, we don't know whether people from different parts of the world, right? Like, at the bottom of everything, where you are born is the biggest factor that decides your success in pretty much any industry, right? Like, look at esports. how many African pros are there? Barely any. Do they have a biological reason why they're not why they're not as good? Of course not. We can't know that. And if there was anything, it would be crazy that it just happened to be the nation that has the least development in the esports scene and so on. And then you look at different games, like in Rocket League, North America and Europe, by far ahead of all the other regions because of the development within those regions. Mm-hmm. So when you look at the sort of the male population, and you look at across the world, mm-hmm. how it's affected different regions and their development, you can then apply that to mm-hmm. men versus women, in the sense that a woman goes into a game, speaks in game, it's a coin flip as to whether they get abused or not. And that's not a healthy way to develop in anything you love. And it instantly makes the majority of people dislike the thing that they're doing. And yeah. I think that's the biggest factor that people don't talk about.
Yeah, there's a lot of teams in the Impact League, the ESL Impact League, which is the Women's Counter-Strike League, where they play great online. And then once they go into officials on LAN, or even officials online, so outside of scrims, they fall apart a bit because they've got all this pressure on their shoulders. Even though they are playing other women, I think they're so kind of concerned about competition and messing up. And I have that situation on stage. I definitely had it for a while. I think I'm better now. I was great in 2018 for not worrying, not giving a shit. And then I started to get worried as I kind of moved up. And now I'm hopefully kind of a bit less self-conscious. But yeah, you've got that kind of foregone conclusion that you're not going to perform, or you're not capable of doing it, because you've been told for your entire life that you're not capable of doing it. But I mean, for me overall, I just don't understand. I don't understand why people have got a problem with it, because it doesn't affect them.
Exactly.
It doesn't affect these people on Twitter that someone gets more, like someone gets the same as someone else, but they've still got an opinion about it. And they're still like, oh, well, they're not making as much money through sponsorship for the broadcast. Why do you give a shit? Why does it matter to you? Yeah, I don't understand that.
It's when the Women's League is the first thing that they start bringing up the economical and sustainable values of a broadcast, when they've never done that for anything else in esports. Because if they did that about esports, they'd probably be talking about every broadcast.
Nothing
in that sense.
Nothing makes money in esports apart from talent and the players that win at the exactly. moment. I mean, maybe some of the orgs are making enough money from merch now, but like, there's so much, you know, venture capital. Mm. These TOs, on the whole, they're not making much money, they're kind of surviving.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
so everyone's trying to get to the top so that when it does start making money, in theory, that they're sat at the top of the mm-hmm. pool of things that are out there. They want to be the biggest show, they want to be the biggest org. Yeah. And at the moment, people are still pushing beyond what they should be to try and get there. So
yeah, new zoo's coming along being like, it's going to be a multi-billion-dollar industry. Well, it's not yet.
Yeah,
so you can't guarantee that. I feel like it's great for people who are looking for capital, because they can go out and they can quote these figures and be like, look, it's going to be worth this much. But it's not there yet.
Well, people quote the gaming industry when they're talking about esports, and esports is this tiny percentage of the gaming industry,
yeah.
where things like mobile games, there are some esports that are mobile games, of course, but like the esports side of majority of games, it's a very select few games, and it's also a very select audience within those games. Mm. And the people who want to watch it are even less than people realize, and so on. So, yeah, we'll see what happens in the future. But we've spoken a lot about your journey, and we have skipped over the question we ask every one of our guests, just because it was so interesting talking to you about your journey, and especially as you've got a unique and longer journey than a lot of people, where most people most people are like, I started gaming at school, and then I got a job. And then
I didn't get my first GPU, like, discrete GPU until I was 28 years old. So before then, I'd always gamed on PCs that was integrated graphics.
And as a 27-year-old person, I'm going to ask you questions about your favorite games.
Sure.
And it should be interesting to hear about the different games that you'll pick up. I'm assuming Final Fantasy will be in there, but what are your top five games of all time?
I do find that really hard. Yeah, Final Fantasy X is going to be in there, just because I had such a, like...
Was that the 2 week in bed game?
Yeah, and I cried so much when I won that. But also, because the penultimate boss, it took me such a long time to achieve. But I know you're going to ask me about gaming achievements, so I won't tell you about the final boss yet. So that's one of them. I would say Counter-Strike, because it's, you know, changed my life, really. I want to say Overwatch, actually. My early days, I built a PC so I could play Overwatch at home, because I used to play in the Twitch office. We built a team called Overlunch. We had t-shirts. We never actually wore them. But
That's amazing. Wait,
it flips a lot.
Have you still got the Overlunch?
I don't think I do anymore. I had a bit of a clear out. Also, like, any merch I have now goes to something called Esports Youth Club as well in, like, South London. I will take the photos because I want to help orgs out. So I tend to, like, if someone sends me something, I do tend to put it on Instagram, hashtag gifted. And then I'll give it to those guys. So that's three. I'm on killing two. And then the final one, I'm trying to, it's really, honestly, really hard. There's part of me that wants to say just that.
Sorry, you skipped over.
Did I say, oh God, what did I say? I can't even remember. What did I just say? Okay, so hang on. Final Fantasy 10, not 15. Oh God, no.
CS.
Counter-Strike. Monkey Island 2 is probably what I
said. Monkey Island 2, yeah. And then you said Overwatch as well.
Yeah, Overwatch. So my final game. So there's a few, like, indie games that I've played in the last few years. I love when BAFTA time comes around because I see the nominations and I'm just like, oh my God, there's so many games I should be playing. There's part of me that feels like actually I should be taking out Overwatch and putting PUBG in just because it also meant a lot to me, but I played more Overwatch. I was obsessed with that. I started playing again because of Overwatch 2 recently.
Mm-hmm.
So final game.
While you think of your final game, do you want to talk about Monkey Island 2? Because I don't know if a lot of people will know that game.
Well, how could people not know Monkey Island 2? Monkey Island 2, point-and-click adventure. It's famous, I guess, for multiple reasons. But one of them is because Tim Schafer, who was an assistant director on that game, went off and set up Double Fine and created games like Psychonauts and a lot of other big influential games, point-and-click game called Full Throttle, for example. He's known as a bit of a hilarious game writing genius. But Double Fine also publishes a lot of indie games as well.
Mm-hmm.
And some really unusual games. Ron Gilbert's the kind of regarded as the creator of Monkey Island. He's the lead game designer, so he literally is. He worked on Monkey Island 1 and 2. Then Disney bought LucasArts games, and Monkey Island 3 he left the production of, or he wasn't involved in. And he came back to the series recently for The Secret of Monkey Island, which was released this year. So I literally finished that game just before Christmas. I didn't love it as much as 2. And I played 3 as well so many times despite Ron Gilbert not being on it. I think part of me was disappointed because they were going to originally, I feel like, do Monkey 3A. So ignore some of the things that happened in Monkey Island 3, like Elaine and Guybrush getting married. These two amazing video game creations. Guybrush Threepwood, who used to play as, and Elaine Marley, who is just the best character in video gaming for me. They basically kind of went with what the series had developed into, which was the two of them being in this relationship, and Elaine became less about having to, like, clear up Guybrush's mistakes and more about campaigning about things. I don't know, maybe they turned her into me. I didn't want her to be me. Monkey Island 2 is a point and click puzzle adventure game, and it's very, very funny. I'd recommend it. I'd really recommend Monkey Island 3, despite the fact that it wasn't made by the original team, because it's also brilliant when you were a 9-year-old living in the middle of nowhere. I completed it more times than I can count.
I'm going to be watching Monkey Island 2 later. I don't tend to play those kind of games. I like playing them vicariously through other people.
Yeah.
So I find them on YouTube and then...
Monkey Island 2 is great. Thimbleweed Park was made by Terrible Toy Box, which is Ron Gilbert's production team. So that was released a few years ago. That's a really great point-and-click adventure game. I really, really enjoyed Thimbleweed Park. Number one, it's really hard for me to say because there's been a loads of really great indie games released recently or in recent years. But there's something about it always comes back to me, which is Katana Zero, which is a Devolver Digital published game. Devolver are just so interesting for me in terms of the take that they're a publisher where you know that you're going to get something that kind of looks classic and nods back to the past, but it's going to have an ultra modern, often ultra violent spin on it. When I was younger, I wasn't into kind of violence in video games, but Katana Zero is so clever. It is kind of designed for speedrunners, but you don't have to be a speedrunner to play it.
Mm.
You play as a samurai soldier who's been injected with something, and you basically have to clear each level, each room of the level of enemies within a certain time frame and also without taking a single hit. And when you do take a single hit or you run out of time, it basically rewinds time because this injection has given you the ability to see into the future. Mm. So you get as many runs as you need to be able to complete the thing, and it's really tricky and frustrating. And I didn't know that, like, when you roll, you actually can dash through lasers. So I learned that very late. And that really helped me when I was playing Cult of the Lamb recently, which is kind of a base builder, you know, like sim kind of city sim kind of builder almost, crossed with a roguelike. And you have to do rolls in that. And I remembered, oh, it's like Katana Zero. You can like roll through the fire.
So that's like a Dark Souls-y thing, isn't it?
Yeah,
dodge mechanic.
Yeah, it's I mean, Dark Souls, you can't dodge through the thing, can you, by rolling? You dodge away, but you can't dodge through.
I don't know. I mean, Monster Hunter.
I don't
know.
I've never played Dark Souls.
I don't know about Dark Souls. I think Monster Hunter, they have it where you can dodge through things.
I played the most recent like Monster Hunter port on like PC, and it was... Monster Hunter World, was it?
Yeah.
It was really frustrating. I'm not into those games, which is weird because I like JRPGs, so but yeah, I just, no. that's not my top five. But yeah, when I'd completed Katana Zero, it was just a rewarding experience, but I love the storyline and they're releasing a DLC sometime this year and I don't know when, but I'm so excited for that game.
So it's like it's like an action puzzle in a way. Like you've
exactly.
Puzzle solving an action scene and then you have to redo it if you don't get it quite right.
Yeah, because you're picking up things from the environment almost like in Streets of Rage or like the old Punisher games where you pick up something in the side scrollers. And yeah, there is a soul... almost like the side-scrolling element, but you only side-scroll when you... I can't remember if there's... Yeah, it's not... I mean, obviously, it's not side-scrolling because you're not going in one direction. There's a slight scroll back and forth. But I'm going really boring about how much I love this game now. But I love that game. So, yeah, it has to be part of my top five, I think, because I still think about it. And I played it a few years ago, but I still think about it.
So you speak about games... Very clear that you love games by the way you speak about them. I think you're the most passionate person so far talking about the top five games. But there is always those particular moments that we all think back to and remember as our top gaming achievements.
Yep.
Now, a lot of people who sit here will reference something they've done for work as their gaming achievement. Mm-hmm. But I feel like, based on what you said earlier, that Final Fantasy X might be a top gaming achievement.
I've got two. So in-game, when I was 16, I beat the final boss of Final Fantasy in two moves. Yu Yevon, it basically... There's zombie spells in Final Fantasy X. I used a character called Auron's ability, Devil Sword, which the zombie ability reverses healing powers because I beat him in two moves, obviously. So I reversed, I basically hit Yu Yevon with the Devil Sword and then I used Yuna's ability Full Life because you could cast healing spells on enemies in Final Fantasy X. And Full Life, the clue's in the name, if you use Full Life on someone who is not hit by a zombie sword, it completely restores their health.
Mm-hmm.
So if you use it on someone who's got zombie magic on them, it completely removes their health.
Oh, genius.
And he did.
Did you plan to do that? Or was it like a last moment, like, oh my God, I could do this?
I can't remember, to be honest. I was so tired because I'd done nothing but play Final Fantasy for 2 weeks. So it was probably one of the other reasons why I cried. But yeah, I was really proud of that one.
And the second achievement?
Second achievement was when I clutched a 2v1 situation and won the match with Counter-Strike talent game show match in Beijing in 2019 at the end of the year, because I wasn't meant to play in that show match. Eric from the team management team came in the green room the day before and was like, I need two people to play in the show match, like, who wants to do it? And I had my keyboard and mouse with me and I had a laptop, but I was in China, so I couldn't actually play any video games while I was there, because, you know, with VPNs and all sorts of things. So I decided to volunteer and knew that no one would expect anything of me. Came out in my little Astralis jersey because it's the only jersey I had on me. And I didn't realize I was in this like sudden death situation because it was next round wins. And I realized, because all my teammates were Mandarin speakers, they didn't speak English. I sort of was going around realizing everyone was dead, and I was like, I can't get the bomb because it's dropped on the site, they're going to be there. So I rotated around the entirety of the map, and then they basically ran into my crosshairs, so I killed a professional player, somebody, and then I killed Stunner. I shot Stunner, my fellow talent, in the head. The 1v2, and that was brilliant because I just remember Moses, the commentator, just being like, and Stunner has collapsed, and there's just this amazing shot from above of like Stunner in the fetal position.
Oh, that's amazing.
So, but I won an Intel like i9, it's probably like 9th gen or something processor, I gave it to him because I'm a nice person, but also I already had one because sponsored by Intel, so yeah.
So you didn't have to worry about that. I mean, I think it's very apt that a talent would remember that gaming experience more than anything you've ever done as talent. Because I'm the same. Whenever I've competed, that's always been my favorite experiences in gaming.
Mm.
You know, I do a tiny little tournament. It wouldn't be worth anything, but I'd still be in the final of it. And that would be,
yeah.
Because something like Twitch Rivals for me, competing in Twitch Rivals was probably one of my favorite moments of last year, yeah. When I did some of the best things I've ever done in my career. But you still just remember that competing experience.
This is my favorite in-game experience.
Yeah, I mean, yeah.
Like, I think, I don't know, it's hard to think about other favorite moments kind of like in work.
There's not as big a peaks and troughs in moments in work, but gaming achievements, you can interpret however you want.
I feel like, Antoine, when I came off stage after doing the sort of the final walkouts, I was really proud of myself for it. Mm-hmm. I got a copy pasta in when I was introducing Faye, so no one appreciated it. It's fine. I just delivered it with such panache that no one noticed. All people thought I was unprofessional. I'm not sure. Because there was a copy pasta about Carrigan who went on to win with his team.
And you said it word for word.
But I didn't nearly. I had to get the words right. I was drilling it in my head. Because it was, he did this, or at least there was a profile about him, this Intel sponsor thing back in like 2018. Not 2018, like 2020. It was like a copy pasta that was just all with the time, but he wasn't the typical nerdy gamer kid in school, blah, blah, blah.
That one.
Kind of thing. And then there was like his girlfriend, like now wife, being like, what I want is for Finn is to win a major. So I sort of paraphrase that. Anyway, so yeah, maybe that's my greatest achievement. I'm not sure. But getting to do a couple of majors is a lovely thing.
Yeah. Well, you've had an amazing career so far. I'm sure you're just getting started. And one of the big things that's happened in your career, which I think is, it sounds really bad because it's such a common thing in everyday life, is you've had a baby, which you mentioned earlier, coming up to 1 year now.
Yeah, which is a year the day after we record this. So yeah.
So the thing I want to ask about this, because it is a typical thing in everyday life. So in every other part of work, I say that freelance is probably not the case, but a lot of jobs, things like maternity leave are built in, maternity pay, you know, people are respectful of the time off you have, and I'm sure people were respectful of your time off, but there isn't an inbuilt system for you to take time off to have a baby. You mentioned that you were on camera 7 months pregnant doing a show.
Mm-hmm.
How did you plan your time around having your baby?
I couldn't fly after that event. I wasn't allowed to. So I was asked to do an event. In fact, I did still do some work when I got back to the UK. I was just kind of not housebound, but like landbound.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, if I'd been able to train places, I wouldn't, all that kind of thing. I did have to suddenly realize that actually I was too large for certain things. I was just so big and I was getting a lot of pain. They call it lightning crotch when you get like shooting pains because the baby's head is connecting with your pelvis. Oh God, like the back pain and it was really difficult. And I was tired and all that kind of stuff. So I realized I wasn't going to do the best job. And esports hours are unpredictable. So just working on events, even in the UK, I felt was going to be too hard. So I did kind of step back from some things earlier than I wanted to. I just had to give myself a bit of time. Then I spent most of that time playing Assassin's Creed Valhalla, which was a mistake. That game stole so much of my life from me.
Didn't make top five.
Oh no, but I've played more hours of that game than most other games. Like, it's insane. But I really liked Ava, so I liked spending time with her. I did have female Ava. It's a hard decision, but like I had to do work when, like, I had to write a script or something when the baby was only 6 days old, then film it when she was 11 days old. And that was really hard because she was in hospital for like 4 nights. We were in hospital for 4 nights when she was born.
She had jaundice, right?
She was born with jaundice. Normally babies develop it because some biology for you guys. When you first give birth, you produce something called colostrum, which is like a thick concentrated milk, rather than the traditional breast milk that one would associate with pumping and things. So a lot of babies, they're not great at feeding it either. They have to learn to do it. If it's your first, you have to learn how to do it. And so they don't get enough, so they become jaundiced. Also might not get enough daylight. Aoife was different. She was born jaundiced. So we had to put on a baby sunbed, which was like a little UV box next to the bed in the ward I was in. And she had little sunglasses on. And yeah, and also I had to feed her as much as possible, so on my boobs and also bottles as well. Mm-hmm. And when I walked out of the hospital, I nearly couldn't walk out of it because I was so exhausted. because I was just like trying to get her out of the hospital, because they do these things called boxes and they test her levels and things, and then they go, oh, we need to get her improved by like 12 boxes. And you're just like, okay, I can do this. So even though normally babies sleep quite a lot, like the day or two after they're born, before the real fun begins, you know, you're like constantly just trying to get them fed. So, mm-hmm.
And what was that year? Well, what's the year been like since having her?
So I'm actually really enjoying it now. Like she's a very funny baby. I mean, everyone's going to say this about their own kids. She's really funny and she's really cheeky. And obviously love her to bits. Like it's funny. Like there's a lot about how when you have your baby and you're instantly in love and all that kind of stuff. And actually that's not as true as people think it is. You're so tired often that you don't have that instant connection. Like I was in so much pain. I've written a blog about it. I won't go into too much detail about various contractions and things, but I was denied pain relief. So I had some paracetamol when I was having my contractions. And then I finally got gas and air in the last 6 minutes of the labor when I was actually pushing her out, because the hospital kept telling me I wasn't having her and not examining me. So nearly had to have an unplanned C-section. But yeah, and I was lucky in some ways. I was very unlucky in most ways, but I was lucky in the sense that I was able to push her out so quickly. But so it's great now, but it was very hard. Like, it's hard for me to talk about. Like I had PND. I think part of that was because stuff with
do you want to say what PND stands for?
Postnatal depression. It was really hard because like a few days, oh god, I don't want to be upset about it. I don't know why I'm crying during podcasts. I think it's because it was really hard, because when she was born, she had a hearing test, and then we found out that she's got a hearing some hearing loss, and she's absolutely fine. She's amazing. You wouldn't know. And also, it's not a bad thing. You can be, if you are deaf, whether that's fully deaf or partially deaf, you're part of this community. It's honestly the most incredible thing. But we don't have any history of deafness, so I thought it was my fault, and you had to do all these tests and things. And we'll never know why, and that's okay. But we were kind of dealing with all those things, and then the news about the ESL takeover happened, and then suddenly you're like trying to deal with so many things, and then you kind of feels like you have the whole internet calling you a terrible person. So it was very like difficult year, and it felt like quite a lot of things were taken. And now I'm kind of at peace with a lot more things, especially towards the end of last year. And I definitely sort of, I was doing a lot of work actually, even when she was first born and things, and we took her to Antwerp to do the major. And I was so grateful to PGL because they asked me to do that major in February. And, you know, I actually had quite a period of time to get ready for it, which is great. You know, and I was so nervous about going to that event and things. But yeah, there was a lot of things to think about last year. I definitely had some time towards the end of the year where I felt the PND was coming back. But I kind of feel okay now, even though I look like I'm not, I am okay. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it was hard. I think with babies, obviously, it's for women, because I can only speak about my experience. Mm-hmm. Obviously, you're trying to rebuild your body, because it doesn't just, you know, I still am physically impacted by having been pregnant, having given birth. And then obviously your time management's completely changed. And then your career and things like that is, you know, when you have the constant guilt, the mum guilt of being like, I really want to work and I really want to retain this part of myself. And also I need to work because I've got a mortgage to pay and like cost of living crisis, heating, mortgage is going to go up because of inflation, like I need to pay for childcare, all that kind of stuff, right? You've got all these pressures on yourself. But also you know, you've got to try and entertain, look after a child and things. So that's hard. It's really, really hard. Like trying to do LEC last year was a really great experience. Desk hosting and doing interviews. I worked so hard on that show. Any moment she was napping, any chance I had, Like, I was downloading VODs and watching them even on the planes to those shows. I was studying for that show because I wanted to do a good job. And I did. I was really proud, but I was also exhausted afterwards. So
yeah, I'm not surprised. I mean,
yeah,
having not only having a child.
Amazing. Great. So yeah, my child took away the ability for me to drink properly.
I appreciate you sharing all that because it's not an easy thing for anyone at the best of times to have a child, yeah. But then to also do what is quite a full-on job in the sense of it takes a lot of work behind the scenes, a lot of energy, right? Like just to be able to go out on stage and release as much energy.
Well, I was still breastfeeding when I went to Antwerp and she had a dairy intolerance. And so I can eat dairy, but I don't eat meat. So I eat fish, but everything had dairy in it. All was meat.
Mm.
There was like nothing I could eat. So I was making myself like a tuna niçoise, which sounds very bougie, I know, like the sort of salad buffet at lunch in the hotel. When we moved to the arena, I could barely eat anything. And there was like a VIP area we had to kind of beg to get into. And it had these little plates of food that came out specific times. And sometimes it clashed with when I was needed. And I was like running to try and get food. And I'd never really done this before, but like after I did the final, like walk-ons, I'd used up so much energy and I was still pumping. Aoife had gone home. She came up for a week and then she wasn't there for the second week, but I was still pumping expressing milk so I could still feed her when I got back, because otherwise you don't use it, you lose it, but also you get blocked and you potentially get mastitis. It's very painful having blocked boobs. I was exhausted because it takes a lot of calories and energy to make milk. And I came off that stage and I nearly collapsed. I had to sit down and I had to speak to producer and just go, I know you want me to potentially do one more hit in the audience, but I don't think I can do it. Luckily it was 2-0, so they didn't need it anyway. And also Banks is brilliant and he would have done it and there would be no issue whatsoever. But that was the one time I just thought, I'm physically incapable of doing this. So, you know, even when I was 7 months pregnant, I did have to leave before final interview for TI, but that was because COVID cases were rising. And if I caught COVID and I tested positive, I would have been stuck in Romania for 2 weeks and I would have missed some crucial hospital appointments. So I had to leave as soon as I was done on that show. Those are the only two times I've like kind of tapped out.
you're very practically minded in the sense that there you're thinking, I need to get back for this, get back for that. But how much impact has that had on, time spent, because you say you bring your baby along with you to events.
Really, I haven't. I mean, it was just that, because it was 2 weeks and she was like 4 months old. And so I got my in-laws and my husband an Airbnb, and so they were in Antwerp for the week and they had a lovely time. They had a fabulous holiday, and like, you know, I got to see them on occasion, and sometimes she came to the hotel and fed. And PJ were amazing. They're like, well, make sure you have a big enough room so if you want to have a cot. They were not fazed by the idea of the baby being there at all. They thought she was probably going to be staying on site, but I was I didn't want any talent to feel put out by the fact that I had a child there. And I didn't want any talent to think that I was going to be bringing the baby to the green room or anything like that. And actually, I think the talent were much more amenable to it than I thought. So it never came up. And then afterwards, I was just like, oh, I didn't want to be in the way. And like Shucks was like, I would have loved to cuddle. And I'm like, I'm so sorry. I should have given you my child.
I was thinking, if I was in the other talent's position, I'd have loved to have met them. That would have been like a nice little break in the day.
I brought her to the green room once because I found out late in the first week that Freya would have liked to have met the baby. So I came down and I was like, here's my child. But Freya, you look too nice and she's a baby, so I can't put her on you, but say hello to Aoife, the baby. And the makeup artist loved her because we filmed this thing on the media day with Aoife. I don't think it ever came out, but the makeup artists were like, they heard around the corner there was a baby and they're like, baby, baby, baby. And so, yeah, they came and gave her a cuddle for a bit. So everyone was lovely.
That's one thing you can count on people is puppies and babies. They will
they'll
always change. They'll change people. They'll make people suddenly speak in a higher pitched voice. And
You know, green rooms are sacred spaces, right? You just don't, I never want to like infringe on anyone's like personal space or workspace or anything like that. So I was like, right, just be professional and, you know, but I mean, I did have to walk around with a pump in, but you know, it goes like a breast pump to pump milk, but it went in my bra. So I come off stage, take off my suit jacket and shirt and then like stick a pump in and just like walk around. But like, I don't feel like that was like crossing a line because I had a t-shirt on, it was fine. But I would tell people about the fact that I was pumping or things like that. But I think that's okay.
So with your line of work, you travel away, you work long shows. With that, it means you have to have good support structure around you.
Yeah.
I don't know if you wanted to talk about it much, but you mentioned your husband, in-laws. Do you want to talk a bit about what they've done in this period for you?
My husband never had paternity leave. I didn't have proper maternity leave. So the in-laws have been amazing when I've had to do have a day to do things. It was very hard at first because if I was working from home, I still felt like I had to be kind of doing things. And so I wasn't getting as much time to kind of focus on the work. And so it was just everything was too much at first, to be fair. If I was doing it again, I'd have to do things differently. But you'd have to because you'd have two. But they've been amazing. I'm really, really lucky. We do have childcare 3 days a week now. So Wednesday to Friday. And that's amazing because it means I can stream and I can have time to prep and just have a bit of space. I do miss her actually now. As they develop more of a personality and become more kind of not independent, she's not independent, but she's sort of, you know, she's moving about and she's playing with things and she wants me to be involved while she's doing those things. But, you miss her more because there's more to miss. There's more personality. There's more of a person there to miss. But it's also really, it's so healthy to kind of retain some identity. And I think that is one of my weak points as well, is that I am so keen to kind of retain that, but that side of me as well. But it's a good thing as well. You know, it's a double-edged sword.
Yeah. And I'm sure you're going to be a point of contact for a lot of people in the future when they start going through all this, because they're going to be so worried, because it is a huge life-changing event to have a baby. And I think there's going to be a lot of people in the industry who, if they hear this, they might learn a little bit about it and be ready for stuff, because nothing goes quite as smoothly as you hope with childbirth.
I remember Zoe telling me from Overwatch, telling me she was pregnant, and that was really exciting. And I know it's a nerve-wracking thing, and she's back in the seat and she's doing fantastically, and she was nominated for Esports Host of the Year again this year because she's fantastic what she does. Mm-hmm. Oh, please tell me that's not my phone. Oh my God, I'm so sorry. I knew it's going to be a mom. Jesus. It's because I'm so sorry.
I was close to when we were starting the podcast being like, have you got your phone on silent?
I normally always have it on silent, but we started so quickly I forgot. I'm so sorry. No, and also I'm not that popular. It's my mom.
I was also tempted to be like, I'm sure there's someone who might need to contact you urgently at any point. So I don't want to put you in that position where you're gone for a bit of time. Because that's in my head, I feel like what you're doing, right now, for example, I appreciate you coming over here for this podcast. In my head, I'm like, oh, Frankie's taking time out of a day, which is probably so busy doing all these things. But as you mentioned, a key thing for you has been, don't let this overtake my life. I can't let this be who I can't just be a mother now. I have to keep doing what I was doing before. You have to do it for work reasons. You have to do it for your own personal identity, because you still want to be Frankie Ward who does all these other things.
I'm definitely much more at ease with the identity of being a mum now, though, definitely. Especially since kind of Christmas. I feel like I've kind of settled into it more, but again, it's because my baby is this crawling, nearly walking comedy character, and she's really funny to be with and fun to be with, and I'm so proud of her and all the developments that she's making. So it's great. It's I've felt suddenly oh, hang on a second, I think I'm part of a double act now. This is great.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm much more at ease with it now. I was not resistant to that label of being a mum and things like that, but I just didn't want people to view me as just that. And obviously I still don't, but I'm much better with it now, I think. Obviously I have no idea what's going to happen this year. It's a typical thing in January. I have no idea what I'm working on this year. I haven't got anything booked in. It's always been that way. 2020 was the one year when it was different, where it was I knew I wasn't working on one thing, but I knew all my dates for another. And it was it was so great. And then COVID happened.
Mm-hmm.
And it was oh my God, just got this house and this mortgage. Oh my God. And then the second half of that year ended up being incredibly busy and it turned out to be okay. So that's what I'm telling myself this time. I don't know what I'm working on. I am available. but yeah, I'm telling myself.
I was genuinely just about to ask, what is next? And
no idea.
I guess there's a chance you to talk about what it's like being a freelance person who just doesn't know what you're going to be doing until maybe a month before, if you're lucky.
I got asked to do things last year, and sometimes it was a week before, and it was I can't do this. I've got a baby. Or I was already booked for other things. And so it was really hard. I'm a bit worried that I won't get asked now because of the fact that I had to say no to those things. But it was just, I can't do things a week before. And it's not just because of the baby. It's because of, yeah, there would be a scheduling clash and things like that. And sure, in 2018, maybe I probably would have jumped at things. And I still probably could do the odd thing a week before, you know, filling in for someone else. But I wish with esports that we had more kind of contracts, and maybe certain things did, because like with RLCS, I'm guessing you were signed for like a year or something like
that. Yeah, but then equally that caught me off guard when I thought I was doing it. And then I moved into this flat thinking I had that guaranteed money.
Yeah, it's and then, hard,
isn't so it? you can never really feel guaranteed.
No, so it's true. And you sometimes have these kind of conversations where people are like, oh, maybe we'll talk about a contract after this or this kind of thing. And then you don't hear anything and you just go, right, I know what these guys are like. Should I just kind of wait? Like, and then when something else comes along, do I then say no to that? Like, there have been times when I've had to make that risk, like, and say no to something because I'm holding out for something else.
Especially for you with your kind of role, you can do anything in theory. If someone wanted you, they could get you for any show as a host, or
they could, yeah.
You've got certain games that you've specialized in, but for example, like Rocket League is a game you've never worked in, but you've said you'd love to work in Rocket League, and if they asked you, you would go away, you'd do the research like you said earlier, you instantly get the homework done.
Yeah, and I know the game. I remember when it was still like not free to play, I bought it on three different platforms.
Uh-huh. Like, and you were there at season two, weren't you?
Out to Rotterdam 2016, not Rotterdam, sorry, Amsterdam in 2016. Was in the crowd, which is where I first encountered Cole and Scumpy, because I could hear them. 10 seconds to go, lads. And that was where I decided I would like to stage host. Mm-hmm. Kelly Linkwood did a fabulous job out there. And I remember watching her thinking she was brilliant, but also thinking, I feel like I could do that. Mm. So I'd always wanted to do Rocket League. The problem for me, and I suppose the problem for them, is I'm not all out Rocket League, and I totally respect that, but I can't commit myself to being a full-time Rocket League content creator. But what I do commit myself to doing is being the best host I can be, and the best interviewer I can be, or on desk as I can be. And for me, that's a skill that is transferable. Mm-hmm. So some people come to it because they love a particular game, and then they learn those other things. I come in with those skills already, and I can learn a game and I can learn a scene. And the most important thing I do with my job is learn those players. And my interviews are about the personality of the player as well as what they've done. So I'm very flexible in the way that I treat subjects and treat players and storylines and things like that. And that's why I feel that I can work in any scene. Obviously communities are different though, so some of them are going to be resistant to me being in those scenes, and some tournament organizers won't like that either. So I'm always up for doing anything. Last year I think was great in the sense that I got to do multiple different things. I got to do some Twitch rival stuff, which was great. Real technical challenge of doing Amsterdam, because there were four different games going on at any time, or even five different games at any time, or no, four different things, two real life challenges, two gaming challenges. And you're like, you've got all this coordination going on, because then there were other shows as well as the sort of main rival show, like with Minecraft and things. So it was like a packed 2 days, to the point where we had 2 days of rehearsal. But that was an amazing team. What they achieved from the technical perspective alone, let alone the broadcast, was just above and beyond. So yeah, it was a good year in terms of trying out different things.
Mm-hmm. And I'm not trying to hint that you should get out the spotlight, but is there any thoughts around going back behind the scenes at any point in the future?
Yeah, for sure. I think if I went back to it, I would like to be an executive producer, maybe, rather than a hands-on producer. So the reason being is tournament organizers, they are typically organizing their broadcast as well as their tournament. They don't necessarily have all eyes on kind of one thing. It can be a really difficult thing. Obviously the producer has on the show and stuff like that, but then you've got the producers of like the pre-production stuff, and then you have the actual run of show and the live broadcast stuff, and there's so many different elements. And I would really like to be a creative lead who is kind of looking at all those things and the storylines, and running production meetings with talent as well, broadcast talent as well, like at the events, but also in advance of the events as well as the wider broadcast team, and going, right, what are we trying to achieve here? creatively overall, and really laying down that concept. Now, I'm not saying that broadcasts don't already do that, but I don't think there are that many execs. So for me, that's a role that I would really love to be doing one day. I think Amanda Lawson, I think, is the exec for Gefinity. Not Gefinity anymore. She was Gefinity. Now she is Esports Engine. But I think I'd love a job like that.
Yeah, I mean,
and working with talent as well, and being the exec, I feel like if you're the producer, you are hands-on, day-to-day run of show, whereas as an executive producer, I can go in and give talent feedback.
That was exactly what I was about to ask, was because you've been on both sides. You've mentioned to me how you've analysed talent when watching shows. You know, you've sort of given feedback through like conversation. You'd be like, oh, that person did this, that person does that well. You've done it for yourself. You know, a lot of what you've achieved has been through analysing other people and going, what are they doing well? What are they doing well? How can I Frankie Waterfy it and then turn it into my own thing? So you've got an eye for talent. And so I feel like that would be a great place for you to be, is a mentor potentially. And through that role, like you said, you'd be able to do that.
Thanks. I'd be totally up for doing that. I think it's a case of feedback. You have to be in the right situation to receive that feedback. So I don't go up to people and like just give them feedback. I would always ask. I tend to, most of the time actually, when I offer feedback or give feedback, it's actually on show reels, because that's a really simple way to kind of open up a feedback conversation and do something. And I'd also only give feedback if it's actionable. And that's the way that I see it when it's given to me, which is, this person is giving me feedback because they know I can action it. They know I can be better and I can work on this thing. And that's kind of a way I'd advise people to look at feedback, when it's coming from the person who should be giving it. When it's coming from some guy on Reddit who doesn't know the situation, doesn't know that you had an IFB going off on your ear like you're underwater and had no idea that you're suddenly last minute having a panicky producer in your ear kind of thing. So, you know, people who are watching the show don't know the context. And like, for me personally, I do not throw production on the bus. If I don't hear something, it could, to be fair, it could be totally to me as well, but I'll treat it in exactly the same way, whether it's whoever hasn't communicated right, again, could totally be me. If I'm really stuck on a broadcast and the camera's on me, so I can't push a talkback button, or I don't have a talkback button to talk to the the producer, I'll just be like, producer so-and-so's name. Like, are we good to go to a break or something like that? I'll literally just do that because it's a stream. So you can do that. And I like mentioning producers and shows as well, because they work so hard. And I used to be one, so I understand what it's like. No one credits you and stuff. And also in radio, as a producer, you're kind of a presence on the show as well. And I feel like streams, they're not TV broadcasts. So I actually do feel like the people who make these shows are so as passionate about the games and things. So it's quite nice to shout out people on the crew and have that family feel, I think, with shows.
Yeah, great chance to shout out Harry, who's sitting here. Did he ever Google the Hearthstone?
Oh my Paradox. God, of course, it's Paradox HS. Check him out on Twitch. There you also go. Likes board games. I'm sorry, Paradox, you're a legend.
If anyone's listened to that bit and got to hear, that's...
Yeah, oh my God, well done you. Yeah. I'm so sorry.
Thank you for listening.
This long talking to me, watching me cry about being a mother.
No, I mean, everything you've spoken about, like I said, is a unique story. You've got a very different journey to a lot of people out there. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the key with this podcast, is I want to share stories of people who've found their way into working in esports, and they have a whole story beyond the game. That's why we call it that, to try and find out about all those other challenges that they have. And I think some of the challenges you've mentioned are very normal challenges. And I think you undersell them because you want to try and push past them and be like, I can do this, which is part of your strength and why you've done so well and what you've achieved, is because you've pushed past a lot of the adversity that is there for the average person has to go on camera, and even more so for some of the challenges you've had to face. So thank you for sharing all of that. And thank you for coming along to the podcast and being here. I appreciate you taking some time out of your day for this.
Oh, thank you. I did overcome pregnancy.
It sounds so crazy when you say that, but it is one of the most traumatic things in anyone, any woman's life. There's not many men who'll be experiencing that.
You did a 12-hour broadcast when you were first trimester, no one knows you're pregnant, and you were tireder than you've ever been in your entire life.
And the fact that you're in a position where there isn't an industry support for it, there's no maternity pay and leave and stuff like that in place. So you did just have to accept that you had to work through it. Otherwise you'd have to take hits in other ways, like money or loss of opportunity because you're taken out the scene for an extended period of time.
We'll see what happens. I'm amazing, guys. Hire me.
But we'll end the podcast here and we'll finish it with the same question we ask everyone. Mm-hmm. What does gaming mean to you?
I mean, it means the world. It means connection. That's what it means.
Connection. Beautiful. Mm. Thank you.
Thank you. Sports Social
Podcast Network. With the Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.